I want to welcome everyone to our Keeping on Track open line. We are celebrating 22 years in business and just entering our 8th year of doing open line programs. We have a few new exciting changes. First, we have a new 2016 open line format that comes with the launching of our new site. You can also find an archive of past topics on our publication event tab. You name the topic, we have covered it either through our publication called Keeping on Track or with our Open Line series. Plus, our new book, Cracking the Business Code, is available on Amazon, or you can click on the book icons on our homepage. Our topic today is The Secret Sauce, A Recipe for Growth. My name is Dana Barocca. I'm the CEO of Lighthouse Consulting Services. I'll be hosting our program today. We have just a few housekeeping items, then we're going to jump right into our topic. For those of you joining us for the first time at Lighthouse, everything we do goes back to our mission statement to bring effective insights to your organization. And we do this through our in-depth work style and personality assessments in helping to raise the hiring bar on both the new hire side and for staff development. Our Keeping on Track open line series is in response to a number of the calls we get from clients, both domestically and globally, to address the various business issues that organizations are facing today. Our goal is to make this an interactive program, so on your screen, you'll see an area you can send questions or ideas during our discussion, and we'll attempt to respond to as many of you as possible. So please join us with your thoughts and insights you have along the way. At the conclusion of our program, we're going to open up the line so you can talk directly with our guest, Mark Emmer. So please write down two or three questions you can either send in on the chat box during the program, or you can hold it until we open up the line at the conclusion. Our guest with us today is Mark Emmer, who is a longtime business, personal friend, great guy. He's a wonderful human being, gives a lot back to the world through his business practice and also through his charitable donations. Mark is a consultant, author, and speaker, sought after by CEOs throughout North America as an expert on strategic planning and performance improvement. Mark's firm, Optimize, Inc., has an impressive client list, which includes C.B. Richard Ellis, Rio Tinto, Superior Industries, and dozens of small and mid-cap companies. The release of Mark's book, Intended Consequences, was covered online by Forbes, CNBC, Fox, and CBS, and his weekly blog is syndicated by Vistage, the world's largest CEO membership organization. Mark has served on various nonprofit and for-profit boards. I feel privileged to have Mark with us today to share ideas that will help each of us in preparing for the future and for dealing with today's business issues. Also, at the conclusion of our program, registration will open up for our next open line next month, and the topic will be the decision-making process, finding your sweet spot. Mark, welcome back to open line, and thank you for being a guest again.
Thank you, Dana, and thankfully, most of what you just said is true. So good morning, everyone. Over the last 14 years or so, it has been an honor that I've been able to help over 120 companies craft their business strategies. I would describe half of those companies as mid-market and the other half as more entrepreneurial. And I would make this observation of those of us who are entrepreneurs. Most of us on most nights we go to bed and we're grateful for the abundance and flexibility that entrepreneurship affords us. And most mornings we wake up and we are excited to seize the opportunities ahead. And in between, there are times that we wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning in a cold sweat, petrified that we could run out of runway. And this fear is raw and it's real and it's based on a universal truth, which is it's intuitive to all of us that any business worth being in will certainly attract competition. It's as if our core competency, the thing that got us here, is on a collision course with commoditization and price pressure and margin erosion. And I think a dilemma that all management teams face is that our reward for building a very successful business is that over time, what we do is we amass more and more concentration risk. It's usually concentration in a particular vertical, or it could be in four or five customers. And then our inclination is to diversify. And then we expose our companies to a whole different set of risks. So most notably, execution risk. We know that whenever we kind of swim into a new market, there's a greater chance of failure in a business that we don't know. So kind of the conversation that I want to lead today focuses on eight ingredients that I think companies need to utilize in order to grow their business profitably. So that paradigm about the entrepreneur's dilemma and growth is my first lens for the content that I want to go through this morning. And the other lens is probably best described through an experience I had recently. I was planning on having this exceedingly lazy Sunday afternoon, and I went to the grocery store to pick up the required nutriments. And I was preparing myself for the walk of shame. You know what the walk of shame is, Dana?
No.
No, that's when you pass the Girl Scout cookies and you don't buy any, the Girl Scouts are not buying any Girl Scout cookies.
There you go.
Right, and so I'm walking into the store and this young lady approaches me and she says, "Sir, can I offer you some Girl Scout cookies?" And I said, "I'm sorry, I don't have any cash today." And she said, "Sir, don't you know we take Visa, MasterCard, and American Express?" And I thought to myself, you know, this is the world we live in. When we're at a place where disruption extends down to the 13-year-old girl accepting credit cards in front of a grocery store, then the lesson there is that disruption really is applicable to all of us. It doesn't matter if your company is large or small, if you're B2B or B2C, we all have to be in tune to the disruption that's taking place around us. So I'm not here to say if you're a smaller company that you'll be the disruptor, but you at least need to be aware of kind of the changing market conditions around you. So you're going to find as I go through the content, I may ask some rhetorical questions because asking questions is kind of my style. That is the way that I like to provoke thought. So when I'm working with a management team for the first time, one of the first questions I ask of people is, what's the end game for you? And so for many entrepreneurs and also for management teams, it's about optimizing the value of their asset. And that might be because they want to sell the business someday, or it could be because they want to provide more opportunity for their senior management or their employees, or they want to be able to invest in things that will improve their profitability. And I always point out that there is an inherent conflict between profit and growth. And as we look at valuations of businesses that have sold in the U.S. over the last number of years, if you see the graph, as most of you know, when businesses are sold, they're sold typically for a multiple of their EBITDA or profit, and the multiples are higher than they have ever been in history. So this is an excellent time to be thinking about, you know, the benefits of optimizing the value. And clearly, when it comes to valuations of companies, size does matter. The multiples are much higher for companies in the $40 or $50 million revenue range than in the $10 million range. And as you kind of go up the food chain, public companies are trading at, you know, 20 times their profit. So if your end game is to increase the value of the business, then size really does matter. So then it becomes a question of how and where to grow. And I have a particular lens for that. You can grow within your core competency. You can grow into markets that are adjacent to the ones that you're already in, or you can do things that are truly transformational. And if you went to a wealth advisor and you asked them, you know, how should you manage your money, what would they tell you? They would tell you that you should diversify. And I want to suggest to our participants today that they should think about growth through a similar lens. Google has a specific strategy for this. They invest 70% of their new investment in their core business 20% in adjacencies, and 10% in things that are entirely transformational or disruptive. And I don't know about those of you on the line, but when I first saw this number, I was quite surprised by it. You'd almost think that it would be the reverse because Google is such a dynamic company. But I think it just reinforces that there's always safety investing in the core. But I think the counter argument to that is there's also a lot of risk in only investing in the core. And frankly, that's the pain I see in the 10 and 20 and even $50 million companies is they mistake continuing what they're already doing as strategy, and that's really not strategy at all. I think if you have a thoughtful evaluation of all the markets you could be in, and you understand the growth rate in those markets, and you make a conscious effort to double down in your existing business because it's a high-growth business, then I can buy that. But a lot of companies will continue to reinvest, and they'll almost be 100-0-0 even when their market is in decline, and the only way that you're going to earn business when a market is in decline is if you're stealing it from someone else, and that is usually those markets where you know, we see the most price pressure. So, again, my recommendation is as you think about your growth, think about what your growth portfolio should be and what percentage of it will come from your existing lines of business and your existing customers, and in what ways will you need to venture out into new markets. And understanding the growth rates in all of those markets is exceptionally important. Okay. So ingredient number one is scalable companies have a growth portfolio that balances core and non-core growth and considers potential industry disruption. So again, I'm not suggesting that you need to be the disruptor, but that you at least understand kind of the market dynamics and how your markets could change over time. So I'm going to walk through six or seven slides that will illustrate some perhaps some innovative ways that that you could think about growing. And first, I'm going to start with adjacencies. This is kind of a checklist that you could use when you consider entering a new market. So what data supports your position that you should enter that market? What I find with a lot of salespeople, frankly, is they're just out with their shotgun, and they're looking for opportunities, and they may enter into a new market for your company without much forethought. So I think whenever you're going to enter a new market, you want to start with a business plan and really understand what the opportunities there and make sure you have the right technology and the right people and the right processes and all of those things. Can you leverage your existing business to enter this market? Can you repeat that formula in other markets should you decide to chase different verticals? Can you be the top dog in this market? Do you know the terrain well enough to enter? And kind of my personal favorite is there a Trojan horse? Can you enter the market and then trade upstream into higher profit categories or products once you enter that market space? And again, please, if you have any questions, if you enter them, Dana will interrupt me. Another excellent place to grow is through vertical integration, and of course this was quite the hot topic back in the 70s and 80s, and back then we had a lot of large institutional Fortune 500 kind of companies buying up their suppliers because they wanted to participate in profit both upstream and downstream. And what I've been noticing over the last few years is two very significant trends. More vertical integration with service companies, and more vertical integration with smaller and mid-market companies. So I will give you an example of one. A longtime client of both Dana and I is Kravitz, which is a third-party administrator of retirement plans. And I started working with them about 8 or 9 years ago. At the time, there was a change of control from father to son. And you know, over the last number of years, you know, they've invested in kind of a strategic planning process where they at least try to come up with one big nugget every year. And so this is some of the things that they've done. First, they realized that they needed to be in a kind of a niche business if they were going to fight off price competition. So they focused on one kind of tiny sliver of the retirement plan business, which is cash balance plans. Another realization they came to is that a lot of their clients wanted advice on where to invest their cash balance investments. So they opened up an investment advisory. Then in another year, they realized, well, the investment advisory is always being asked, well, where should the money be kind of planted? And they realized there was no natural place for cash balance plan investments to live, so they created a cash balance mutual fund. In another year, they thought, well, our competitors don't really understand this market space at all, so why don't we create a portal so that we can kind of leverage our competitors' sales teams, and we can create a situation where they will become our sales team, and we will manage all the back end and all the actuarial services for our competition. So they created a portal and a new product. In another year, they realized, well, no one understands this market better than us. We are the thought leaders. So what we'll do is we'll write a book, and we'll have the CEO of the company and our two top salespeople co-author the book, and then we can go out to conferences and we can speak about cash balance plans. And then the other thing they did was they created a series of webinars that they would sell to these competitors using the portal and to various wholesalers that are selling their product. And actually realize a different revenue stream that way. So what I'm really describing is a vertically integrated model where Kravitz, at the time when I first started working with them, was maybe 35 or 40 heads. They have multiple profit streams. And when you have multiple profit streams, that is the way that you can fend off price competition. And it's like when the customer comes to you about wanting a better price on one service, you're able to make it up in another service, and you make your business much stickier than if you are kind of the one-trick pony trying to sell one product or service into one market. So think about ways that you can extend your business. Here's another couple of examples where I've had a couple of clients do some very interesting things. One was a manager of like nursing homes and retirement communities. And so they had all of these assets deployed in the form of, say, nursing homes. And they came to realize that, you know, they have these internal functional departments like accounting and IT and HR that provide services to the nursing homes that are fairly nuanced. So, for example, accounting in a nursing home is nuanced because it's all Medicare. So what they started doing was selling that accounting service to companies that were like them, who were non-geographic competitors, and they created an entirely new revenue stream. Similarly, I work with another company that is operates charter schools, and they did exactly the same thing. In their case, the HR is nuanced because in charter schools you're hiring teachers. So they started selling their HR services and even branded it as 9DOT and are selling it to other charter school operators around the country. So those would be some examples of some ways you could create new revenue streams that didn't exist before and fully utilize the assets within your company. Dan, I'll pause for a second. Do we have any questions so far?
I know we're doing. Those are great ideas, Mark. We were talking to a client yesterday, and their manufacturing organization. They started a whole other group within their HR department, which supports their sales division. So they were finding that in order for them to sell their product, one of the issues was that the potential client was having problems in finding operators for the machine. So HR said, well, what if we start a recruiting division, find the people, we do the training, get them in there, and then we get a fee for it on the back end. Brilliant.
Right.
He now made HR a profit center.
Exactly. Right. All right, so I'll keep going.
Yes.
So, of course, another way you can grow is through acquisitions, and It's no mistake that I have poker chips as my illustration here, because I do think acquisitions is a lot like gambling. You had better know what you're doing. It can be very expensive if you make a mistake. And there is some kind of science and math that we're seeing that best illustrates how acquisitions are most successful. So let me explain what this table means. The chart represents the percentage of time that the objectives of an acquirer are achieved in an acquisition. It's the percentage of time that the objectives of the acquirer are achieved in an acquisition. And what you'll see is the numbers are low when the focus is on reducing cost. And I think that is why the Fortune 500 is having such a difficult time in having successful integrations of their mergers and acquisitions, because what they're doing is they're scaling for scaling's sake, and they overestimate the amount of cost reduction they can get. They're thinking, well, we'll cut this 500 headcount in this division, and they're only actually able to cut 250. Conversely, acquisitions have the most teeth when the focal point is on improving the value proposition for your customers. So as any of you on the line think about doing deals, I would suggest to you that you focus on, well, what does this mean to the market and our customers and our ability to provide better service? And that should be the lens by which we consider acquisitions.
Mark, a question came in around the acquisition slide. We hear a lot of horror stories about post-merger integrations, and I wonder if you have any thoughts for the group on making sure they're successful. You just shared some ideas. Are there any other thoughts around that?
Actually, yes. So by the way, all of the references are at the back of the presentation, but the table I just showed you came out of an excellent book called Five Frogs on a Log, which was written by some Price Waterhouse analysts about M&A. And one thing that I took out of that book and just a general observation is I think there is a thought process or maybe even an accepted best practice that after an acquisition, people should be given some time to kind of warm up to the new culture and be given the kind of the illusion that they're going to be autonomous. And what they advocate for in the book is, pull the Band-Aid off. When during an acquisition, both companies are under stress, so it's kind of like the old axiom that you should hire slow and fire fast. You should be diligent in your due diligence, and then you should try to effect a very quick integration so that there's less pain. And I just think, companies need to be transparent and be truthful with the folks that they're acquiring on. And it's most of the time, it's a bigger company buying a smaller company. And let's not kid ourselves. The culture of the larger company is typically going to prevail. So I think you try to take the best of both companies in creating a new culture, but typically it's going to be the acquirer's culture that's going to be the one that's going to be most prevalent. So
thank you.
Sure. So ingredient number two, scalable companies constantly evolve their business model and seek out service innovations. And I want to stress service innovation over product innovations, because that's where you can deliver more value. So as you think about the most valuable companies in our economy, companies like Facebook, Apple, Amazon, eBay, and Uber, I would point out that more than being technology companies, these are companies that have created a platform. So similar to what I just described with a small service company in Kravitz, what these companies have done is they have created these multifaceted platforms that have many revenue streams and that have many tentacles and new ways that they could make money. And on the left of the slide are some of the attributes that we would most often see in a platform company. You're going to have things like ultra convenience and seamless transactions. Education is really hot right now because education is cheap. Being able to create webinars online is so easy to do, and a great way that you can kind of drive home your value proposition and potentially even create new revenue streams. Co-revenue is sharing revenue with your customers. And radical pricing is thinking about pricing through an entirely new lens. And I would suggest to you that's often one of the fastest ways that you might be able to disrupt the market or create a platform. So let me share a couple of examples. This is one of my favorite slides in my deck. And this is of a company that's based in San Diego called Renovation Realty. And I'd ask you to think about the fact that the root of almost all innovation is solving everyday problems, and that's what this company has done. So let's say Dana and I are about the same age, I suspect many people on the line are as well, and this is a problem that you may have faced recently or will face in the future. So our parents are getting a little older. Many of them have lived in the same house for 30 or 35 years. It's in disrepair. And the day is going to come that they're going to need to move out and move to a retirement type community. So what this company has done is they have solved a problem for someone like me and said, all right, well, we know you're busy and you don't have time to deal with all these details, so we will move your parents to their new community. We will renovate their house. We will finance the construction, and then we will sell the house for you. So previously, that would have been four different services. And independently, those four services are pretty commoditized if you think about it. So we're talking about construction, moving vans, realtors. But in combination, the platform that they have built is very, very powerful. And someone like me would pay top dollar for it because of the ultra convenience that they could provide. So similarly, I think another kind of advantage of example of this way of thinking is, let me go into the radical pricing a little deeper. So I worked with an advertising agency on the East Coast, and most of their projects would run around $100,000. They do a lot of data analytics for B2C companies. And about 3 or 4 years ago, they went out to the market and they started testing a new pricing strategy. And they told new prospects, hey, look, we can do this project for you for $100,000, or we'll do it for $50,000, and we'd like the opportunity to earn another $100,000 commission. In other words, they asked if they could have some skin in the game. And then something quite unexpected happened. The close rate on the fixed $100,000 projects went up. In other words, the prospects were saying, if you are willing to have skin in the game and take a lesser upfront fee, it sounds like you have something figured out that we don't know. And so I'm not suggesting that any of you on the phone should blindly put skin in the game and take some risk with clients. But what I'm saying is when you do take risk with clients, you change the entire conversation. So if I offered up to any of you, what would you think about having business partnership? I think the word partnership is overused, and the reaction for many of our customers is, I don't really want a partnership. You know, I am the customer, you're the supplier. So this is a way to reframe the conversation. And in the case of my client, just by making that offer, they actually found that their revenue expanded in their existing kind of fixed price. So something to think about. All right, ingredient number three, scalable companies identify how they will leverage technology for competitive advantage. So here's my viewpoint. Over the last, I would say, 5 or 7 years, I've been hearing a lot of conversations that have sounded something like this. Technology director comes into a budget meeting and says, you know, we spent $600,000 on technology last year. I need $700,000 this year. And collectively, the management team, they grunt and they groan and they say, why is technology so expensive? And they really think about it as if it's a cost. And I think we're getting to a point where it's kind of tired and old to be talking about how can we, you know, put GPS in our trucks to make them faster or to reduce theft or whatever. And I think it's kind of tired to talk about, well, how can we use, you know, an iPad in the warehouse to improve our productivity and picking orders. All of those things are internal kind of productivity improvements. What is clearly happening in almost every market is the technology companies are going to win. So every company needs to ask of themselves, how can we create a competitive advantage through technology? In other words, how will we outwardly facing with our clients make sure that our technologies improve the customer experience directly? You know, and this, I kind of skipped over this, but this is the ERP system that we see in a lot of companies. It's, you know, a zillion spreadsheets that are very confusing, and they don't serve their internal customers well, and they don't serve the external customers well.
So we have a manufacturing company mix today. We have different levels of service companies. Mm-hmm. Some are familiar with ERP or MRP systems, and others may not. Could you take a second and explain?
Right. So ERP is Enterprise Resource Planning. So those would be the back-end systems that integrate all of the systems in a company. And that's actually a timely question because it relates to where I'm going with these next couple of slides. So we're in a unique place in time, and a lot of these technologies that we're constantly reading about, like, for example, cloud relational databases and big data, what's interesting about them is up until today, you know, most companies kept most of their information on their private servers. And in the revolution we're in at the moment where things are moving to the cloud, that's just for the sake of convenience or reducing cost. It's that once the databases are able to speak to each other, they're far more powerful than they would be individually. So what happens in the world when QuickBooks can integrate seamlessly with Salesforce or whatever systems that folks are using today? That is when we are able to compete more readily with larger companies whose competitive advantage is better integrated systems. They have the big fancy SAP ERP systems and we don't. And I'm not suggesting that you have, you know, go spend $5 million in a computer system. What I am saying is we need to recognize the tremendous upside we will have when all of our information is integrated and we're able to use that for competitive advantage. So I think a good example of, you know, one of these catchphrases is big data. Let me show you what a smaller company is doing. This is a client up in Calgary, and they create software solutions for the insurance industry. And you'll notice in the example on the slide, this is an example of their application sitting on an iPad. So in the one application, there is a photo database, there is a mapping database, and in real time, the insurance salesman can get three real-time quotes for the customer that they're sitting in front of and show them all on the iPad. So all big data is combining information from multiple sources so that it is more meaningful for the customer. That is a very, very powerful idea. And I think a lot of your small and even mid-market companies are kind of struggling with how they will be able to incorporate big data. You know, and I'm here to tell you that it's very possible, but only if you can marry up your systems so that you have an opportunity to kind of slice and dice it. All right.
Great example.
Yeah. Moving ahead. All right, I'm going to shift gears. So the first section of the webinar today, I've talked about some things you might all think about in terms of creating a growth portfolio and in terms of where you might invest in growth. Now, let's assume that you've made all those decisions, and then it becomes a function of how do we make sure that our value proposition continues to resonate in the marketplace. So I just want to share briefly some ideas about that, and it's kind of based on an observation that almost every market that I've been involved in has what I refer to as a cadence of competition. So what I mean by that is that competitors, they start to look and act and smell the same. Their trade show booths are similar. The language that their salespeople use is similar. So I want to share some ideas on how you might go about breaking the cadence. And the other distinction I would make is that there's a big difference between creating value for a market and being able to demonstrate what your value is. So ingredient four is scalable companies identify market vertical segments and specialties where they can prove their value. I don't have a graphic to show you on this, but I just ask you to think about it visually for a moment. I go to a lot of websites, for example, of companies that claim that they are specialists in a thing. So accountants will say that they're specialists in nonprofits, or attorneys might say that they're specialists in real estate. Or it may be that a design firm says that they've done a lot of websites for schools. But the difference will be that the company that says they do websites for schools is they will show examples of the websites they've done, and they'll talk about what their very typically what their capabilities are. What I see with a lot of other companies is they make a claim that they're a specialist in a thing, but they have no video testimonials to support it. They have no white papers. They have no content that demonstrates that they're a specialist in a vertical. So if you make a claim that you're a specialist in a vertical, make sure you have a dedicated landing page for that vertical and the supporting information that shows why you're great. You know, otherwise, you know, you're just the same as umpteen other suppliers that, you know, make a very similar claim. Sorry, Dan, a little delay on moving forward the slides.
No, this is great. Good. This is great stuff. Thank you.
Ingredient number five, scalable companies have differentiated value propositions in each sector they serve. So your value proposition may be slightly different based on a vertical because the competition and the customers are different. But of course, it's critical that you have a value proposition that's differentiated. Sorry, Dana, I'm having a hard time advancing these slides. There we go. All right, so I want to suggest that there are kind of two different vantage points that you can have as it relates to differentiation and your value proposition. The first vantage point is you could decide what the purchase triggers are of your customers, and you could align with those purchase triggers. So here's an example of a client who's done this very, very well. So on their website, what you'll notice is on the bottom of the page is that there are five purchase triggers that they think are most important to clients. If you click on any of them, they will tell you why they're exceptional at executing against that purchase trigger. And in fact, you'll see number one is short lead time. If you were to scroll down on their webpage right below this hero section, they actually have their real-time lead time stats. Once upon a time, a prospect went into the office of the CEO, and he asked if those were truly real-time. CEO walks them into the plant, pulls a monitor around, and shows them that those were real-time stats, proving that they were very good against that purchase trigger. That today is their largest client. Very important that you at least understand what the purchase triggers are. And I'd also note that I think they've done very well here is you'll notice number two is competitive pricing. They don't suggest they're going to be the cheapest. They only suggest that they're going to be competitive. And they do it within the context of all of these other things that are important potentially to their customers. All right, so the other vantage point is to decide what's important to you and then align with customers that share your value system. That is a very, very different approach. So I refer to that as inside out. So if you're interested in being inside out, this is an excellent exercise that you can execute on. So grab your sales and marketing people, pull them in a room and ask them, you know, who do you think, and you might want some operations people as well, but what in your mind makes up an A client? What are the attributes of your very best client? And it's usually, this is very much a Pareto principle thing, right? It's probably 5% of your clients would make up those A clients. But just list who they are and why they're A clients. And do the same thing with B clients and C clients and D clients. And one caution I would have is don't just do it on revenue. Think about, well, an A client, they pay us on time. They send us the specs when we ask for them. They don't re-engineer engineer products while we're actually shipping them. Their rejections are low. You know, we share a value system. They're honest with us. They'll tell us what their strategy is so we can try to be prepared to serve them in the future. Right. And then here's the hard part. A couple of you will cringe as I'm saying this, but as you have conversations with C clients and they're saying things like, well, our professional procurement committee has met and we've decided that arbitrarily we'd like you to cut your prices by 10%, the conversation you have with that client is, well, I'm sorry, Mr. C prospect or client, but we can only reserve that pricing for our very best clients, and this is why they're our best clients. And while that might be a very difficult conversation to have, it may end up opening Pandora's box on why your relationship with the client is a C. And I would also suggest that some of you are thinking, wow, I might lose some clients that way, and that's absolutely true, but firing C clients may not be the worst thing that ever happened. I actually went through an exercise like this with a client once where they had about 2,000 customers. They realized about 500 of them were unprofitable, and what they did was they raised their minimum order, and in the following year, about 250 of those 500 clients dropped out, and the profit of the other 250 skyrocketed, and they moved up their gross margin an entire point in the following year just by firing their C clients. So when you think inside out, you don't really concern yourself with firing C clients because they're the ones that are not in alignment with you in the first place. Okay, and then the other thing that as it relates to inside out and value proposition is I think you need to have a nest. What is the thing you're very best in the world at? So, you know, are you the easiest, the quickest, the cheapest, the hottest, the biggest, the safest, whatever? And by having that est, it allows you to focus on the thing that you can do best kind of in the customer's value chain, and then just try to achieve a tie on the other things. You can't be the best at everything, and in fact, some of those purchase triggers may actually be in conflict with each other. A client may expect you to have, you know, the lowest cost and also the most inventory. So you kind of have to pick and choose the trade-offs that you want to focus on, and then purposefully just try to achieve a tie on the other things or kind of as close as you can get to a tie. So whenever we're in a transaction, there are kind of three sets of purchase triggers that we typically see. There is functional value, technical value, and emotional value. Emotional value trumps functional and technical value almost every time. So if you were a CPA, an example of functional value would be doing garden variety tax returns. Technical value would be doing the high-end trust work and business work, but it's still the CPA taking his or her clients out to the, you know, the very best country club on the weekends who is building emotional bonds that are very, very difficult to break. So emotional value always trumps the others. I'm not going to be able to I'm going to skip over this. So let me kind of give you an example of using an emotional trigger. So my wife and I, we went to this nonprofit event several years ago, and I decided to buy a new tuxedo. And I went into the department store, and I told the salesman, you know, I really like that white dinner jacket look. I think it looks kind of elegant. So he said, all right, let's see how it looks. So he grabbed one off the rack, and he threw it on my back, and he says to me, that is James Bond. And I thought, never in the history of mankind did a transaction close so fast, right, because I wanted to be James Bond. But had I presented three black jackets, you know, I would have gone through this very logical kind of analysis, and I would have looked at the quality of the lining and the material and so on. But once I was James Bond, ball game was over. So I'd like to suggest that a trap that a lot of companies are finding themselves in today is that they're in technical or functional businesses, so therefore they use technical and functional language. And in framing your value proposition in all your marketing and your sales script, you can get to the technical and functional language, but you need to create a connection with the client first on why they would want to do business with you. So that's why in terms of websites and those types of things, you need to make sure that you first make that connection, why you'd be a great company to do business with, and then there's ample time to get into the kind of technical and functional details. So just be wary that you're not skipping that step. All right, so here are some of the criteria by which customers may buy, or you can create differentiation. We obviously don't have time to go through them all today, but what I would suggest that you all do is get with your sales and marketing team and make sure that you're all clear on what the differentiators are. There should be at least two or three levers that you can pull over and over again. Marketing is about repetition, so you just want to make sure that everyone agrees on what your differentiators are, and then you have to have proof. You have to have actual proof on why you're great and whatever differentiators you choose to leverage. And then kind of final point, ingredient number 7, is scalable companies have a written strategic plan that unifies management. I just believe in my heart of hearts that the best-run companies, they do 3 things. They have a vision for the future. They're able to measure their effectiveness in implementing that vision, usually through like scorecards and dashboards and that kind of thing. And then they bring their employees along for the ride. So it's sometimes the CEO, they think that, you know, they have kind of their strategy and their vision in their head, and that's enough for them, but it may not be enough for their employees. So I think it's very important that you have the written strategic plan, that your objectives, your action items, your KPIs are all very clear. And the companies that I've been around who are best run, they reinforce that over and over again, and they're doing it all the time. So per Dana's question at the beginning of the call, you know, that's a cycle that you repeat annually, and that's something you follow up on every month. And it's not just something that you do once a year and put away in a file drawer. So just want to recap a few maybe of the actionable steps of things I've talked about so far. Important that you plot your growth plan. Important that you have content that proves your value on any claims that you make. Consider if you can create a platform and what the different steps in the value chain in your industry might be and how you could participate in more steps in the chain. Ask of your management team, how can technology be a competitive advantage for your company? And don't just settle for things that are process improvements. Sticking again on me. There, ensure that your marketing delivers an emotional message and that you make memorable connections with your prospects and your customers. Make sure that your sales and marketing team agree on what your differentiators are. Make sure that you have a strategic plan that's written, clearly understood, and unifies your management team. And make sure that you know what the value drivers are in your business and you're constantly measuring your effectiveness in delivering against those drivers. So then my closing point for everyone on the call is this, and that is I just want to implore you all to lead with vision. It is very easy to get kind of sucked into the day-to-day activities in running a company. And, you know, if you really are going to have the balanced portfolio and you're going to think about industry disruption and you're going to grow your business over time to optimize its value, that means that the management team needs to maintain a strategic viewpoint. And, you know, if you don't believe in the value of your goods and services, nobody else will. So important that you're leading with vision every day and that you're allowing that vision to cascade down throughout the organization so that all of your employees come along for the ride. So I appreciate your attention this morning. I'm going to leave you with my very favorite quote. It was from the great Yogi Berra, who said, "The future ain't what it used to be." Thank you very much.
Mark, that was phenomenal. For those of you hanging in there, we got to hear the entire program. We're going to open up the line in just about 60 seconds. For those of you who would like to sign up for our next program, it's called The Decision-Making Process, Finding Your Sweet Spot. You can sign up today. Also, if you want to include friends or other colleagues, please let them know about the program. We're also going to be sending out the recording for today and a PowerPoint of the program so you can share it with your team. And this topic of strategic planning is a big one. And if you have additional questions for Mark and want to talk with him directly, his contact information is on the screen. Again, I'm going to turn off the recording feature in just a second. We're going to open up the line for everybody. I would suggest that if you could put your phones on mute and then unmute your phone to ask Mark questions. But before we conclude, Mark, thank you so much for being on this program today. It was absolutely phenomenal.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. So let's open up the line. Just one second.